I have received several letters from organizations and individuals in the from the first American nation, the American Indians. In addition to these letters, I have received valuable, if not priceless, gifts from them. Just this morning, I received a number of gowns from them. They had wanted to robe me at the airport, but unfortunately, our convoy left the airport before arrangements could be made for them to perform the ceremony. When the robes came and their letter, I was already here. I then requested the mayor to allow me to meet this delegation, which is led by Mr. or Ms. Cooper. Unfortunately, we were unable to contact them despite the diligent inquiry by the mayor. These letters, which I have received, describes that the conditions of the American Indians here. And I can assure you that they have left me very disturbed. If I had the time, I would have visited their areas, spoken to their leaders and their organizations, and got from them an authoritative picture of the difficulties under which they live. But unfortunately, my schedule is very tight, and I cannot carry out this wish. But I can assure the leaders of the Indian community that I will return in October.
The late, great Madiba Nelson Mandela, speaking in June 1990 at a capacity-filled stadium, the Oakland Coliseum, as part of his American tour following his release from Robben Island and 27 years of imprisonment and the lung infection that would lead to his death just a few days ago and his burial this week. We are celebrating his life with the possibility of your supporting WBAI with a pledge at our number 212-209-2950 to get the book and double DVD by Danny Schechter, Madiba A to Z, The Long Journey of Nelson Mandela, as well as his film, Close-Up, of Madiba's visit to the United States. And Mandela was speaking about divestment, and that brings back memory to me, the mid-1980s, I was news director, and it was at one of the rallies on divestment at Columbia University, where the idea of divestment, of Coca-Cola's support for apartheid at that time, was the source of the entire quadrangle being filled by people of goodwill. And there I wandered, as that guy at MSNBC, I wandered amongst them. Obama came amongst us and gave me an interview. And I did that with a stereo recorder, Jim Frein. And that was the introduction of Stereo News Actualities here at WBAI, the newscast that I invented the conclusion right up until we no longer have a news department. And that's some of the news. It was a counterpoint to what Cronkite would say at the end of his newscast. So this is WBAI. It is tinged with history and justice, and I hope you'll support it with continuing calls, not only for Earthwatch, but throughout the rest of the night and day. 212-209-2950. Ask them about the Madiba A to Z package. It's a fabulous book. And thank you, Danny Schechter, for your time. And I'm going to ease on out of here. Welcome your emails, rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. And Jim, you have the con, and I leave it to you for your acoustically artistic transition. I'm Robert Knight, rknight at WBAI.org. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund coming up next.
It is you.
And Earth Night, Earth Watch with Robert Knight, Earth Night with Robert Watch was brought to you live with portions on recording. I want to mention that Robert, who, by the way, has been so gracious in giving me airtime on important state occasions like the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, screwed up my Thanksgiving show because I was all set to play a mix of certain things only to discover that you're like the Firesign Theater on the Indians and all that. And it's like, I'm all set to start out with that, and you just played it.
Great brains roll in the same gutter.
Yeah, tell me about it. Mine doesn't roll. It just sort of like, you know, squats there. So you were playing all this fabulous stuff, which was exactly what I was going to do, making me change course. Thank you for that, because that's live radio. That's freeform radio is the... That's the name of the pieces. Temporarily Humbled Country. One of the great lessons in American history, as brought to you by the Firesign Theater, Pacifica Radios. Firesign. Two from K, one from A, and one from I, or at least formerly of I. David Osman worked here as like in the music department at some point, and basically went out west to be with the rest of the Firesign Theater. So most of their programs came out of KPFA. No, KKK, Los Angeles. I'm not going near that, hailing on Pacifica, WBAI. Now we're going to do a soft pitch, and then I'm going to start my theme music. But, you know, how many stations are turning over their airtime to Mandela as anything more than a tip of the hat and something that they think will, I don't know. That's well put. And you know, here at WBAI, people like him is why Pacifica was made and represented the open-minded kind of thinking, fierce and calm at the same time, which is what I admired about him. And Robert knows Pacifica and WBAI history, as do I. We're both sort of historians of the station. And February 11th, 1977 was a horrible, horrible day in which one of our many battles with our owners got so far that we were taken off the air for 6 weeks. The local board voted to... we were going off, and then we would come from another location and another location, and finally a showdown in the Empire State Building at the transmitter, where it took them another 90 minutes to shut them down, where Abe Aig, our news director, was saying, right now the news is not in Afghanistan, the news is not in Vietnam, the news is here right now. And that was a momentous day. Five people were arrested at the Empire State Building. building, Bob Fast, Margot Adler, Abe Ake, Steve... No, Steve Rosen... he was a tech guy who was around for years and later got jailed for some very nasty stuff, which didn't surprise me a tiny bit. And Mike Edel. And Mike Edel. Good guy, Mike Edel. Now with TechServe. And February 11th was for some of us. He said, beating his chest. Can you all see on the radio that I'm beating my chest? A day in which we said, WBAI staff, you know, we rock. We own this. But it was also a dismal day because really the beginning of the wars. The wars. It was also a very painful way of forcing the station to become multicultural in a way that really had not been. And sometimes you learn through pain, and that was part of it. But we also haven't fully recovered from it yet. And so February 11th was a date that would live in infamy. And there was a 10-year anniversary party for that event at Margot Adler's house. And there were maybe 50 or 60 people. She is quite the living room. From BAI. And on February 11th, 1987, I think. 10th year anniversary. I think it was 10th. It comes the news where we're all sitting there and we are told Nelson Mandela has been released from jail.
And thus the circle.
And all of us were gathered in this room and there was utter silence. And then one person, I think it was actually Larry Josephson, said, well, at least February 11th now has become one of the most positive days in history for us instead of one of the most negative days in history. I'm sure somebody can look up and find out what day he was released from jail, but it was a February 11th. And so in the name of the revolution and spirit of WBAI and the freedom of Nelson Mandela and the freedom that he gave so many people... I was going to do a soft pitch, and I started sounding like it's you, Robert. It's your shoe thumping ability to preach. because it's so infectious. It's so that energy just sort of rolls off. So I don't know everything about Danny's pitch. What we don't have paper on it here. What is the premium? Called, what does it cost?
Mandela A to Z. Madiba A
Madiba,
to Z.
Thank you. Madiba A to Z. And what? It doesn't cost anything. If you give us a gift, we will give you a gift. Thank
book
you.
Book and a half for two DVDs and the book. You might can get the book by itself.
$150?
Book and a half, yeah.
Buck and a half. Yeah, there's no decimal point in that buck and a half. It's $150. Tax? No, is it tax? Yeah, it should be. Yeah. Well, sometimes we have to take off what when there's a book. Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. When BAI in the 70s was in its high point, Danny Schechter was doing similar radio in Boston on a commercial station.
BCN.
And he was Danny Schechter News Dissector. And he was doing a lot of baseball. I actually did a baseball show, and he and I were trading tapes. I still never met the man. He is a great, wonderful journalist, and he's written a couple of books now and made a couple of documentaries. And here he has emerged with this book that just came out like last week.
A double DVD documentary up close with Nelson Mandela and his tour of the United States.
For $150. So if you donate $150 to WBAI, we will donate this DVD, this two DVD set, and the book back to you. So thank you, Danny Schechter. I hope one of these years to meet you because I've always been a fan. And this book has, sadly come along at exactly the right time.
It's sufficiently complex, even though it's laid out simply like the alphabet, but it's sufficiently deep and thoughtful and analytic as to engage.
I haven't read it, so you like the book. You liked it. Mm-hmm. I take it you liked it.
Yeah.
Okay, that should be enough for listeners. So give a phone call now, 212-209-2950. We have a wonderful guest, and I want to get to my wonderful guest. So give that, make that call, and we're not going to ever interrupt that guest because we have Kiini Burasalam. I've been saying Burusalam off the air, and it's like, why am I doing that? And she says it's because of Uhuru, and I really hope that's not what's resting in my poor addled little brain. She is a wonderful writer. This is her second time on Hour of the Wolf. So let's get Hour of the Wolf started and move on. But to do that, we need listener support. If this station is going to survive, if we are going to show Pacifica that we are self-sufficient and worth our own self-governance, then we need, yeah, right, Robert, I see that face. Everybody in the radio audience sees that face. We need you to be among us and prove that the concept of listener sponsorship works. 209-2950, area code 212-209-2950. So now I'm going to move over to the computer, which is why I'm going off mic. Please forgive me, and begin the theme music. By the way, if you are listening in the future, which means you're listening to the archive cast, there's nothing stopping you from calling and pledging and getting Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela by Danny Schechter. You can also, by the way, become a BAI buddy. $10 a month is what we're asking for that, and for that, you will get one thumb drive with some amazing, amazing speeches and documents from WBAI's history, which I was very dismayed that there was no Julius Lester on there, by the way. One of my favorite problem makers here at WBAI, because he made good problems. Anyway. That was the pitch, and now we're actually going to begin the show. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, you did it, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Kiini Burasalam, a wonderful writer of short stories. Stay tuned.
once loved a sailor, once a sailor loved me. But he was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing. And every evening at midnight, he would come to my window and sing. Come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars. We'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing, no one will know as we swoon. So come take a trip in my airship, and we'll visit the man in the moon. Just by the dipper I gave him my heart, the sun shone on our honeymoon. We swore to each other we'd never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my,
singing a song from, I think Rick Bowes told me that it was like actually a 1911 song, and I thought, oh, Rick, you don't know everything, but I was wrong. He does. It's.
I love Natalie Merchant.
Yeah, she is so much fun. She and it's a wonderful song. Take a trip in my airship going to Mars. And it was actually just sort of done as a little Irish ballad, apparently, out of Boston. And she turned it into this kid song.
Yeah.
She gave it this different spin, which is really lovely.
I could even hear her doing it as an adult song, but that, you know, with her own sort of weird take on it.
Except that she had some kids backing her up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it starts out more or less, as you say, as an adult song with fantastic, fun, strange concepts of romance stuck in there. And then it just turns into this flight of the imagination.
Awesome.
Which, so I love her version. When I was on Saturday morning still, and preceding me, after the last time you, Kiini, were on our air, Fred Kuhn, calling himself Fred Geobald for reasons I never understood, preceded me. But then I was later on, I was preceded by the absolutely wonderful Habte Selassie, who's still on our air Friday mornings, and everybody must listen to his show because he's wonderful. And Ian Forrest, who now has his own show here, would be producing and helping Habte, because if there was a football game anywhere in the world, and Habte could somehow finagle a way to get there, Brazil, Ireland.
You have to have a passion. You have to have a passion. It's going to take you far.
He
maybe
was there.
Mars. You have to have a passion.
He was there. So Ian often preceded me.
Yeah.
And I'd say, Ian, what am I playing? He said, there's no choice. You play Natalie Merchantman. And guess where he's from? Yeah. I almost got the voice right.
Yeah.
Almost. Sorry, Ian. So, yeah, we have a thing for her.
Yeah.
So, with us this morning, it's been years. And then you didn't have a book out.
No, and it was right after I finished Clarion, the class of 2001.
Uh-huh.
I came and talked about Clarion, read a story
from
Dark Matter. And many, many years have passed.
Yes.
And now I have the collection, Ancient.
Mm-hmm.
Which won the Tiptree last year. So
that's right.
Well, it won the 2000 Tiptree, and I got the award this year.
Yeah.
And it's been...
Oh, you actually got... What does the Tiptree Award look like?
What does the Tiptree Award look like?
Well, for people who don't know, the Tiptree Award is an award basically for stories that deal with gender and multicultural thinking. James Tiptree Jr. was actually Alice B. Sheldon, and a person formerly involved in the intelligence community. Her husband was CIA, and she had worked with the CIA, or OSS at least.
And she successfully presented herself as male for
quite some
time.
Oh, I absolutely bought that. I was one of the people who said, obviously, she's male.
Right.
Because the person who wrote the story, The Women Men Don't See, so obviously understood the male way of thinking, the male mind. And people say, well, did you get it wrong? And I say, no, I didn't. She wore that personality.
Yeah. Amazing. I think it's...
And by the way, it's a great biography of her. I'm forgetting the name of the woman who wrote it, but...
Yeah, it's interesting how we're allowed to quote-unquote know what we know,
mm-hmm.
and how much of it is relying on what we already perceive when we know what we're dealing with, as opposed to coming to something actually objectively, actually not having any of those visual cues or already thinking that we have.
Yeah.
It's completely different. I had an art teacher who he put up like 10 pieces and said, pick out which one a man did and which one a woman did. And we were all convinced that we could, and none of us got it right.
Yeah.
Because we think we know what a female artist will do or a male artist will do. And really, everybody's individuals, you know.
Yeah.
There are trends and there are assumptions and there are, you know, sort of approved social ways of behaving. But it's not so cut and dry.
Yeah. I mean, some men can write women convincingly. I was in science fiction.
Yeah.
I thought John Varley did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Dickens was never able to do it, and he tried any number of times. He just...
And that was fine, because what he brought was, you know, interesting in and of itself. I don't think everyone has to do all one thing, you know?
Yeah, but he tried and he did it, well, not that great.
Yeah.
But Alice B. Sheldon was James Tiptree Jr. And the Tiptree Award, I think, is one of the coolest awards out there. You know, the Hugo is nice. It's a popularity award.
Yes.
The Nebula is cool because it's a peer award.
Mm.
But the Tiptree Award is an elite award given by people who know the bleeping difference.
Yeah. And always an amazing panel. Every year, a different panel.
Mm-hmm.
And
always an amazing winner.
Thank you. So kind.
Yeah, but it's true. It's true. I mean, you take a look. You're in very, very, very distinguished company there, and they were not taking a look at a writer of short stories, which very often short story writers get not noticed as much in awards and in the public as novelists are.
It's very true. Something Octavia Butler said, you were talking about Clarion the year that you might have gone and who were the teachers.
74.
Yeah. And so when I went in 2001, it was Octavia Butler, Nalo Hopkinson, Jack Womack, Ellen Datlow, Bradley Denton, and Connie Willis.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was wonderful from beginning to end. And one of the things Octavia Butler said, I was using the bathroom, I was in the stall, and I was just griping, as I always do, about writing novels. I don't want to write novels. I just want to write stories, blah, blah, blah. And from the next stall, you know, she had such a distinctive voice. You can't make a living as a writer just writing stories. You have to write novels.
Yeah.
She was,
I don't want to get into it. I still am tortured.
Yeah.
And she still owes me a show.
Yeah.
I'll tell the story very quickly. She was in town in to get the God help me, the up here in this building at City College, the
MacArthur?
Black writer, Raisin in the Sun.
Lorraine Hansberry?
The Lorraine Hansberry Award.
Ah.
She was accepting the Lorraine Hansberry Award, which is a major award.
Yeah.
And so she was pretty tired.
Mm-hmm.
And I was recording an interview with her in her hotel.
Yeah.
Near Washington Square. And she was tired and all that. And she said, well, I'm coming back in like a month and a half.
Mm. Mm.
And I said, okay, you get a pass.
Mm.
You know, I recorded the half hour. I say, you come on the show live in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And you get a pass. We don't have to continue this anymore. You rest.
Yeah.
And it was 2 weeks later that she, and as we were getting up, she got up a little too quickly and had a bit of vertigo, which was a problem that she had. The stairs there were very steep.
Mm-hmm.
So at her home, she had built a house primarily for her mother with the money from the MacArthur grant, the genius grant that she got. And she had just had cement steps poured. And the steps were a little too steep, and she was carrying groceries. And she fell down and hit her head and died. And I don't deal with death well.
And was there for some time, too, right? Before she was discovered.
Yeah, and I was just... It's devastating. Yeah. I was devastated.
Absolutely devastated.
And I didn't know what to say. Now, I was calling Cherie Renee Thomas.
Yep.
Who was she was the curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which I have always recorded. Now I'm... and
that's how I met you.
Yeah, that's right. And I was executive producer. I sort of like... So one of the curators sort of said, well, that's it, the series over. I said, no, it isn't. And
it
I started.
Will never end.
It w- and I started choosing curators.
Yeah.
And Cherie, Carol Cooper, friend of mine, pointed out Cherie. And I know to trust Carol. And Cherie is just amazing.
Yeah.
And I was on the phone with Cherie, and I was saying, well, obviously, yeah, do you want to be on the show this week? I have to drop whatever I'm doing. She said, why? I said, Junie, which was how some intimates knew Octavia Butler. And she said, what?
She didn't know. Oh, my goodness.
And I just told her, like, because I assumed that she knew, and she had no idea.
Oh, my goodness.
And she just hung up.
And she was
I cannot talk.
She was so supportive of Dark Matter. She was so supportive of Cherie's work.
And that's, you know, we have to push Ancient,
yes.
we have to push Dark Matter.
Yes. And so are you still going to do your Octavia Butler show? Have you done it? And
oh,
are
I've
you still
done
going to? Okay.
Yeah, my headphones just fell apart. I've done more than one.
Okay, great.
And
we'll continue to do
and
so.
I will continue if, you know, whatever happens to this radio station, if I'm not broadcasting, I'll be podcasting.
Yeah.
And I have, 4 or 5 hours
great.
Of Octavia talking and some readings that she did.
Love it.
And stuff like that. And then there's her fiction to deal with.
Yes.
And my God, does her fiction need production as radio drama? Mm. And they're actually starting to get to the point where anybody listening out there, a movie maker?
Yeah, and they've optioned her work.
Oh, yeah. Everybody.
Millions
yeah.
of times.
Getting optioned is fine.
Yeah,
you know, it's
but
free
you
money.
Get all the way Every, there.
Almost anything. I've had people come on the show and just read stories hoping that they would get optioned. It was really weird. There was a run for about 3 years
yeah.
where almost every story that was read on my show by writers got optioned.
Did you get a cut?
No.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you off the air who that one person actually like got on the show and specifically read certain stories.
Wow.
With the hope that they would be optioned, and they were.
Wow, I got to change the story I'm reading tonight.
Whoops. No, but that was like 15 years ago.
I'm kidding.
Yeah.
But I'm planning to do a celebration for Octavia Butler, not on the scale of what Tananarive Due did at Spelman with Samuel Delaney.
I still
and
never met her. Yeah, no, I was there.
You were there.
I was there. I recorded it.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
And so very different from that. This is not personal to that extent where this panel, people all pretty much knew her. But at the Brooklyn Museum on February 20th, N.K. Jemisin, myself, Evie Zaboy, and
yeah,
this
you see, that one I missed.
Poet.
I was at the one here in Harlem.
Oh, okay.
At the library.
Oh, great.
That was a huge
yeah.
event.
And I feel like it's definitely like she was already expanding her reach beyond the core community who knew her as readers. She was
yeah.
already expanding her reach. But there is something so compelling about her vision that now there's so many sort of communities that are bringing her to light as much as possible. So I hope that we all continue to do that. Cause
yeah, we have to.
She's so amazing.
She was amazing. She was an amazing teacher.
Yeah.
There was a show. We did a show. And it was right after the second
Parable
book mm-hmm. came out.
Devastating.
And
devastating books.
And she said, you didn't like this one as much, did you? As the first.
Yeah.
And I said, I think that I thought that it was a little more didactic.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading more teaching
mm-hmm.
in there instead of simply, you know, the first book, Parable of the Sowers.
Mm-hmm.
I got.
You were there.
I was there. It
you
was
were there.
It was adventure, and if there was learning going on, it was simply because I was there and a part of the experience.
Right.
And you couldn't experience what she was writing.
Right.
In
it
her
was so
stories.
Wedded to Lauren. It was so. All of those social realities were so wedded to the character. So it
exactly.
wasn't like the author was telling us.
Yeah, but
right.
in the second book, I think that she was a little, she told us a few things.
Yeah.
That she stood out and she said, where did I do that? And we were outside, it's, you know, it's 7 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
We just finished 2 hours on the air and we sat outside
mm-hmm.
120 Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And we're both holding our copies of the book, only mine was autographed. And I said, here, this passage here. And she said, oh, my God. Oh, my God. If this was one of my students. I said, no, it's a wonderful book. But yes, I did feel at a couple of times, because I'm not a fast reader.
Yeah.
Not for her.
Yeah.
There are some people I just breeze through.
Right.
I'll read a Philip K. Dick novel in 2 hours.
Right.
I'll read something of equal length
right.
by Octavia Butler in 6 days.
So many layers, right? And then so many relationships with the different characters and the power hierarchies. There's a lot to take in.
Yeah. But we have to change the topic because I want to mention one other thing and we need to talk.
Oh, and get back to the tip tree.
And get back to the tip tree and then get to your reading.
Yes, of course.
But Dark Matter, I have to do this once or twice a year.
Yes.
There are science fiction changes when certain books come out
yes.
to sort of identify where it is at.
Mm-hmm.
And I name five, maybe six, anthologies that encapsulate what science fiction was and moved it to the next realm.
Yes.
And the first ones were probably the Star Science Fiction books by Fred Pohl, mm-hmm. and maybe along with that, the Orbit anthologies edited by Damon Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was Dangerous Visions. Mm. And Dangerous Visions is the first book that really encapsulates a moment, created a new way of looking at science fiction, and with old masters and new voices at the same time, dealing with stuff in a new way. At the same time that Samuel Delaney is putting out, by the way, he's finally being named the Grandmaster from the Science Fiction Writers of America.
That.
It's about freaking time.
He already was. He already was.
He was already there, but they they had to formalize it, and they've done so. Anyway.
Yes.
Chip was the first person I worked for at WBAI, may I add.
That's wonderful.
See, I digress. I interrupt myself and I lose track. After that was Women of Wonder, edited by Pamela Sargent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another book that, you know, said, okay, what are voices that are not being heard? And people are not. Oh, you're Joanna Russ, the same year put out Female Man,
mm-hmm.
another book that just broke science fiction in so many good ways.
Right.
And then there was nothing for quite a while. Oh, there was Mirror Shades. Mirror Shades defined cyberpunk, which was such a powerful movement, edited by Bruce Sterling. And that helped define a subgenre of science fiction. And then there was Dark Matter. And Dark Matter, at the time Dark Matter came out, I was known for saying, you know, I can name the number of prominent black science fiction writers on one hand.
Yeah.
Until I read Dark Matter.
Yeah.
And it's not just that Cherie Renee Thomas was bringing forth new voices like Ini Obura Salam, mm-hmm. and Amma Patterson, mm-hmm. and so many people whose names I did not know, but I'm reading this and going, oh my God, this stuff has been there.
Yes.
And I didn't know it.
She took a whole historical view. She was sort of defining the space, and then she took it way back from W.E.B. Du Bois, the comic.
That's who I was going to mention next.
Showing the threads of
Mr. E.V.D.
of what this imaginative thinking looked like.
Yeah.
Like at a different time period. Whether or not you might think, or the casual reader or the average reader might think to identify it as such. But by putting these stories together, she was showing the threads of the imaginative that's been there in the literature.
And I submit there hasn't been another book that has broken the barrier since Dark Matter.
Yeah. Well, would
yes.
you, this is not an anthology, but what about Nalo's Brown Girl in the Ring?
Novels are fine, but it's one great, brilliant, fabulous, incredible writer.
I hear what
and
you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we could say the same about Octavia Butler. And
but then
that.
You could say that's an anomaly. That's one person.
That's one
person. I see what you're saying.
Anomaly,
yeah.
Not an anomaly. That's a member of the movement.
Yeah.
But it was the book Dark Matter that changed my worldview.
Yeah.
I mean, Brown Girl in the Ring and other books by Nalo, including her latest and the title, which just escaped me, continued to do that.
Right.
But it was these short stories that, for me, say, take a snapshot and make a statement. The book, in and of itself, makes a statement
in the
of a community, of
a writers.
Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it not only showed that this stuff had been there, but was in the, what's the word, the understream.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting for me is that I had been writing speculative fiction out of my own personal interest. I was writing a few stories that were, I would say, just regular fiction, and I got bored. And so there was a moth on a wall in one of my stories, and I was like, what if that moth is carrying a message from ancestors? And I just went off and did my thing. And Sheree and I were working at Random House together. She worked in publishing for years.
Yes.
She was working in a romance department.
Mm-hmm.
And I was temping. And we got to talking about her project. And I was like, oh, let me send you something. But being involved in dark matter and doing the promotions, I was introduced to the science fiction community.
Mm-hmm.
So although most people, I think, in the genre come from a science fiction perspective or a speculative fiction perspective where they grew up watching certain films and reading certain books, and then when you meet another, you know, kindred soul, and then you can go off talking about this history, I didn't come to it through the same way, but Sheree then opened the world in the reverse. For me.
A lot of people who were in dark matter came from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
They were coming from simply being people and writing what was within them and not even knowing. There are any number of people, fine, great writers, who say, I didn't know I was writing science fiction. That's cool.
Right.
Or speculative fiction. Or
right.
Call it what you will.
Right.
Science fiction is the wrong name for it.
Right.
But we accept it.
Right. And because when you think about it, though, what we were reading, you know, I was born in the 70s. So what I was reading as a young person in the 80s, you're reading Ursula K. Le Guin. You're reading A Wrinkle in Time, Madeline L'Engle. You're reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You're reading speculative fiction.
Yeah.
And you're not reading it as speculative fiction. You're reading it as a book to read.
Yeah.
You know? So the idea, I mean, I've always felt a little bit uncomfortable because I might write something that goes in this direction, write something that goes in another direction. I'm writing the things that interest me.
Yeah.
And then if I send it to, say, a mainstream literary publication, this is not plausible. And I'm like, it's all fiction. What are you talking about?
Yeah,
like,
right.
We all made these stories up, you know?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. And then me, I'm working on a novel, and it did not have magic in it. And mm-hmm. I was paralyzed. I'm like, you know, my audience won't read this book because there's no magic. There's so many people who are so religious about what they read and what they don't read. You know, to be someone who's just trying to let the stories come through you, sometimes it can be a little challenging.
People confine themselves to a ghetto of writing.
Yeah.
That, oh my God, I'm writing science fiction, so where's the rocket ship? Where's the future? Where's the science in the science fiction? It's like, no,
right.
no.
Right.
That's not what it's about. And I had a person on the show who wrote mostly science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember who it was, but it doesn't matter. And read a story on the air, and it was a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved every minute of it. And then all of a sudden, somebody called up and said, how is that science fiction? It wasn't.
Yeah.
But it was the genre of blank writer.
Right.
That writer is the genre.
Right.
And that genre can be in science fiction. Maybe it's in mystery. Maybe it's in simply the imagination of that person. Maybe it's an essay.
Yeah.
It's all part of that person's art.
Right.
And being. And that's, so if it doesn't fall into science fiction, fine.
Yeah. And there are things afoot within, I think, the speculative fiction community that there was an article, I think it was saying the year of sci-fi that wasn't sci-fi or something like that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, at Aresia, I was on the panel. We read the Hugo winners and we talked about it.
Yeah.
And I almost didn't want to mention this because I don't remember every story we read, but they weren't, the majority of them, out of the four things we read, one novel, a novella, and two stories, they weren't. There was a magic element,
mm-hmm.
but you would not say this is a sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Keith Johnson, there was the magical element of the weird foam water
mm-hmm.
and this being that was in. But the being kind of whooshed around, and that was the speculative element. But the story was a very human story of an isolated character, blah, 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 blah. I think maybe, was it Charles Tan, the paper?
Yes.
Yeah, again, there was one magical element in the mother's hometown. Mm-hmm. The they could animate the paper and this little paper origami that lit. But it was about this kid and his coming to terms with his relationship with his mother and his culture. You know, each of these stories, interestingly enough,
They're supposed to be science fiction started out being a literature of ideas. And then all of a sudden they discovered that there are people.
Yeah.
And they're still learning that. There are still, by the way, many barriers to be broken.
Yeah.
One person who's leading the way in barrier, and this, I hope, will be one of the forthcoming breakthroughs after Dark Matter, Ken Liu, who is not only writing some brilliant science fiction, mostly short stories, but he's working on a novel now because...
You gotta write a novel.
Gotta write a novel. But... his translating is incredible. And he's taking modern science fiction from China and translating idiomatic concepts that cannot be brought to Western thinking because the mindset is so different.
Yeah.
There is no God. There is something God. I mean, you don't want to use the word there is a force because people are going to, use the force or something like that.
Right.
The Zhang, the thing that is there. And he has been writing these, translating these stories that are breakthroughs.
Yeah.
That there is people. And, oh, my God, the people and the culture.
Yeah. And just think about all the world cultures out there with the different languages which contain different realities and then their mythologies and their stories, and where that could take you.
And an area of fantasy that used to be a major, major area of fantasy in Western literature sort of disappeared and is only starting to come back, the arabesque story. Which is to say, Muslim writers.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean...
Saladin Ahmed.
Saladin. Thank you, Saladin.
Yeah.
And you owe me a show. And Detroit, please. Anyway.
And then Sophia Samatar, she just wrote Journey Out of Alondria.
I don't know her. I have to learn, you see.
She's of Somali descent. She's American.
Ooh.
Of Somali descent. But I haven't read the book. I've heard nothing but amazing stuff about it.
And by the way, if people want multicultural, Karen Lord. Karen Lord is amazing.
Yeah.
She is amazing. Yeah. But
she was on the judging board of the Tiptree.
Ah, was she?
You like that segue?
Excellent. Excellent. Perfect
but
segue.
But
I'm proud
award?
To have had Karen on the show.
That's amazing.
Oh, she's... God.
Yeah.
Great. Very quick story, and then we'll get back to the Tiptree.
Okay.
Karen visits WBAI at 120 Wall Street, where you were, and we had a beautiful view of the harbor.
Yes.
And she takes a look out the window at our view, and she says, so what I'm seeing here is that when the glaciers left, they sort of formed these rivets, and you can see where that's just a part of that island over there. Is that Governor's Island? Yes, it's Governor's Island. Well, that's obviously the glacier sort of like left a little droplet of water as it was receding, a rock, and it turned into rock, and that's how that island was formed. I'm going, oh, my God.
And it's completely obvious, she's saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's just apparent. She just...
Yeah.
What a mind, you know?
Right.
And talk about somebody who knows how to synthesize cultures and bring them into a living, breathing, brilliant... Oh, God. And she's another person I hate, loathe, despise. She's a genius. She's well-traveled.
Yeah.
I have to rebroadcast her interview.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting her.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
She is. I really hope she gets this way again.
Yeah.
But the Tiptree Award.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were going to say something.
I was going to say another person in terms of cultures and worlds, N.K. Jemisin, just how she sort of creates a world that's clearly based in different cultural experiences, but always sort of acknowledging class differences. Like her worlds have all these different sort of levels of life, and you kind of delve into all of them. So it's not just one flat sort of world that people travel in and out of. It's all these different levels of society, you know?
Yeah.
so interesting. And she's the guest of honor this year at WISCON.
And bravo. Yes. Brava. Brava.
Yes, exactly.
And Nora, it's been like 2.5 years since you've done a show. And I know that you work for a living and all that, because great writers often, you know, they have to hustle for a living.
Yeah.
But if we move to 388 Atlantic Avenue, as we are supposed to, you're going to have no excuse, Nora. Your time has come. Or I'll just, you know, we can just record somewhere. You know, that's fine, too. But
yeah.
but it's been too long. She comes to the Nursef readings. I have to interrupt. There are announcements I have to make. There are readings.
Yes.
There are readings to promote. A reading and oh, God. Of course, I printed it out and I didn't bring it with me.
Oh, no.
Okay. This Wednesday at the KGB Fantastic Fiction readings are Thomas F. Monteleone. Thank God I remember this, who I read for years. I've never met him. And a good, fun writer. And a person who's been on this program, oh, 3 or 4 times, Daniel Jose Older, who is coming into his own now.
Oh, yes, he is.
And being recognized. And he's doing a novel. Although, I got to say, Salsa Nocturna, you don't need a novel when you have these connected stories like that. And let me tell people, don't just read Daniel Jose Older. Go to a performance where he's performing music while he's doing the reading.
Yeah.
He has an art form going there that transcends.
Yeah.
And more than he knows.
He's doing more than a novel. He's doing a YA novel.
Yeah.
As well as a adult speculative novel. So he's.
I didn't know he was doing an adult speculative novel. And
yeah.
he has an anthology coming out with Rose Fox, Long Hidden.
Yep.
And he's doing an issue about music for Cross Genres magazine.
Busy, busy, busy.
Yeah. And so he's going to be reading this Wednesday.
Oh, great.
At 85 East 4th Street. Admission is free. Please buy a drink at the bar. And for more information, just Google up or KGB Fantastic Fiction. The Evil. A twin of my reading series, a New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
They are the evil twin of your reading.
Or am I the evil twin of theirs? Mine came first. Gordon Van Gelder started ours 22 years ago, and they're the newbies. They're only about 14 or 15. Datlo says it's like 10 years old. No, she's been working on it more than 10 years.
Yeah.
So theirs is about 15, 16 years old. Terry Bisson started that.
That's awesome.
That series.
I'll be doing that in January.
That's right. You are.
Yeah.
You are. And and it's a very cool thing. So that's this Wednesday, 85 East 4th Street. I hope to be there, but I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make it. And then the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will be the next one. The last one was such a great turnout. We turned away 40 or 50 people. It was amazing. But the next one is going to be Sam J. Miller and Jen Brissett. And I had them both on the air because at one time they were both running reading series of their own. Sam's being, I say gay, he says queer, which is a word that I'm never comfortable with because I grew up in the late 50s. I'm born in 1953.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it was a pejorative.
Yeah.
It was
one of those reclaimed words.
Yeah, and I, you know,
you can't do it.
Reclaimed words don't work for me because it was drummed into my head.
Yeah.
As, you know, I don't mind somebody saying I have a queer feeling in my stomach, but when somebody says I'm queer and I'm proud, I'm going.
And probably many of the people using it now aren't the people who heard the pejorative.
Well,
term.
Exactly.
So,
because they're youngsters
right,
like Sam
exactly.
J. Miller.
Exactly.
You know, who came on the air and I said, well, you're doing a queer reading series. And he said, perfect words. He said, thank you for speaking out of your zone of comfort, Jim, because that's the term I like. I thought, oh, how well put.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what it is. It's not that it's not right that they use that. It's just outside of my zone of comfort.
Yes, understandably.
And then Jen Brissett.
Who just sold a novel to my publisher, Aqueduct Press.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went, when Jen was on the show and she read her story, she had not published a single story at that point. I don't think Sam did either. I think they were both unpublished.
And I have to say, Jen, when she was the owner of Indigo Books in Brooklyn.
One of the great, wonderful, lost little community bookstores.
Wonderful community bookstore. She was extremely supportive of science fiction in general. Very knowledgeable, very supportive fan. But she also was supportive of me and Evie Zaboy, who went to Clarion West. She held a reading for us, a fundraising reading for us.
At the store.
At the store. And she was regularly hosting important readers, important people, writers in the sci-fi community.
So yeah, well, it's time to support her as a writer.
Which is amazing. You know, she's been in the game.
A long time. She really has been. Sam Miller is a rising voice.
Yeah.
But so is Jen.
As a writer. Exactly.
It's her turn as
exactly.
a voice.
It's wonderful.
And she is a brilliant writer. She's in the same writer's group as my partner, Barbara.
Oh, okay, cool.
They're in the same writer's group.
Yeah.
And actually, I recommended that Jen... So I had a little hand in that. Rick Bowes is in that group as well.
Uh-huh.
And some other very, very good writers.
That's awesome.
And,
so Aqueduct is 2 for 2 with the Tiptree. The year before me, it was Andrea Hairston.
Yes.
Redwood and Wildfire.
Yeah, what a wonderful book.
Yeah, and then me, Ancient, also Aqueduct Press.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what this year brings.
So speaking of Ancient.
Yes.
Came out at this point, what, almost 2 years ago?
2012, May 2012.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so a year and a half ago.
Yep.
And you did a reading at the, I hope not stillborn, Kindred reading series.
No, it's slumbering a little bit.
It needs a home.
It needs a home.
It comes up, if BAI moves to 388 Atlantic
that
Avenue.
That would be amazing, yeah.
And if my reading series stays at the Soho Gallery, which is questionable, it depends on the future of the gallery.
Yeah.
But if BAI moves to 388, there will be, I haven't even mentioned this to BAI or to Jen, but let me just say, have I got a match for each of you.
That's great, because I mean, I think half of Jen's battle as she was organizing our readings was venue.
Yeah, venue.
A different venue every time, somebody pulling this, that, you know.
Yeah.
So difficult.
Yeah, it really is. But I want to help her, because that has been so far, there hasn't been a misfire in one reader.
Yeah.
And you were the very first one.
Yes, and I'm actually going to reread the story that I read that day. My friend told me that I seemed more interested in socializing that day. It was my very first reading for this book, and I was just so excited.
Yeah, I remember.
I was just so excited just to be out and representing.
And I got me an autographed copy of the book that day.
Yeah, and you were recording.
And I was recording, and although the recording is not perfect, and it was the first time that I was recording with, I had the recorder for a while, but first time I was using it with a camera. So I have film. I have film of that reading, but the sound is just not that great.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, but it's definitely been a wonderful experience. One of the things that I did for some readings is that, like, when I went to New Orleans, when I went to Atlanta, I would invite local writers to partner with, whether I knew them or not. Because sometimes, you know, you're doing 3 or 4 readings, you don't want to hear yourself all the time. It can be more compelling to exchange with someone. So it was interesting just to hear people sort of tell me what my themes were and kind of like define what I was doing or whatever. But it just is so great to be able to put my work together in one collection, represent it, let it travel out into the world. And it's just been an amazing year and a half just representing the work and getting back great feedback.
Yeah.
And getting a chance to just have my vision out there.
Have you thought of an audiobook?
I have not thought of an audiobook.
You and I will talk off the air.
Okay.
I have never done one.
Huh, interesting.
But it's time, because I'm now an editor. And, oh, yes, host of Lightspeed Magazine's podcast.
Nice.
As of this week, I'm actually the host. And the first one that I hosted, I almost hosted a story by Sam Miller, who did not even know that they were doing a podcast of his story. He knew that they bought the story.
Yeah.
But he didn't know that a professional narrator, Stefan Rudnicki, Paul Bamer,
yeah,
who's known for Star Trek, and I was the editor, nice. Post-production editor. I almost hosted that one. Nice. I mentioned to Sam, your podcast goes live next Tuesday, which is, by the way, 2 days ago. No, last week, so it's live now. People can go to lightspeedmagazine.com and hear it.
He thought they bought it for print?
Well, they did buy it for print, but they also bought podcast rights, and he didn't know. He didn't know. And talking with the narrator about this, he says he's done entire books, and people didn't see in their contract. They didn't even know that their books were being done as audiobooks until they see it on Audible or someplace like that.
Yeah.
And Sam said, oh, yes, I listened to the podcast, and it was so weird to hear my very, very, very personal, deep inner thoughts coming out of somebody else's mouth.
Yeah, yeah. Podcast, so did a podcast of one of my stories, Debris, mm-hmm. and it is a completely different experience, like hearing it. I didn't recognize sort of the humor in the story as much.
Uh-huh.
And
those different interpretations.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, but I am one of the few people where I love the writer's voice.
Mm-hmm.
I love to hear... I mean, there are a lot of podcasts out there, a lot of professional narrators. This is becoming so big, which is why the last Nursef reading that had all these great professional audiobook people performing, like Kathleen Kellgren and Barbara Rosenblatt, working with Ellen Datlow, who has, 20 years experience at National Public Radio, mm-hmm. WGBH, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major thing out there, but very, very, very few. Ellen is one of the very few people lucky enough to narrate her own work. Mary Robinette Kowal is another. But here on Hour of the Wolf, ever since Margot Adler started this show and I took it over, we tend to either I do it, or somebody, or the writer does it.
Yeah.
Those are the only choices. Hello, Lister. Our next show is here, so we better get started reading now that we have an audience. Are you going to, like, hang and sit, or what are you going to do?
I'm going to hang and sit.
Okay, very good. What's on Burn Baby Burn Clapper this morning at 3 a.m.?
The American flag burning to ashes.
Oh, that's what you do every week, is you burn the American flag. your story is like 20, 25 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And we have about that much time left to our show. We're having too much fun here.
Yeah.
And, any program directors listening, I need more airtime. But, and you can see why.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you're appreciating this kind of talk, you, the listener, 212-209-2950. Become a BAI buddy for $10 a month. Or get the Danny Schechter's book and 2 DVD set, Madiba, A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela, for 150 clams. A donation to WBAI will earn you those things. And isn't it nice to be pushing that instead of some of the other things that we tend to promote in exchange for donations on the air? Really, really good book and DVD set. So you can call 212-209-2950 and ask about those options. Lister, I'm going to ask you a favor. Kiini, oh, by the way, Kiini, Lister,
hi.
Kiini, is going to read a story. Beg pardon if, like, we run a minute or two over. I know that you're good with that. Well, so be comfortable, Kiini. Okay. Anything you want to tell people before you start?
Let's see. Beyond the fiction, I also write a blog about writing. So for 10 years, I've been writing about, how the difficulties and the struggles that happen backstage mm-hmm. in the writer's life. So, the difficulties with self-promotion, difficulties with producing work, balancing life and writing, your voices of doubt. And those things are on my website, Kiini Ibura, K-I-I-N-I-I-B-U-R-A.com. And I also have two ebooks. So over time, I'm going to anthologize basically the whole series into ebooks, all about sort of the writing life. One is called On the Psychology of Writing, and one is called, The Struggle to Self-Promote. And so over time, I'll be gathering more and more stuff. I'm very passionate about.
And you're
going to
be repeating that web. If people are like racing now, going, oh, it's 2:30 in the morning.
It's my name.
Yes, but we'll be spelling it out again after the story.
Yeah.
So everybody, get your pen and paper or your tablet or whatever it is that you need to write this website blog down. So. Be aware of that. So we're going to be giving you all kinds of information on how to access Kiini's writing.
Yes.
After the story.
Yeah. Okay, and I've changed my mind again. I'm going back to the story I was going to read.
Oh, okay.
Which is called Rosa Mojo.
You don't mind if I take some photographs while you're doing it?
I don't mind.
Okay, they're going to be posted, you know.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Rosa Mojo. Eyes half closed, I see the dark of Daddy's pants. My bedroom door swings open. Light rips into my room, then disappears. I am alone now. Daddy's footsteps get softer and softer. I can't relax till I can't hear him no more. I turn my face to the wall. My neck is sore, but that's better than it being broke. My breath goes from fast to slow. Then I start to notice other things, like the moon glowing outside my window. My legs shaking so hard I can't stop it. My fists clenched tight. I open one hand. It's empty. I hold my fingers up to my face. It's dark in my room, but I can see two white marks my fingernails made when they were digging into my skin. I squeeze the other hand tighter. A soft, springy clump of Daddy's hair shifts in my palm. It would tickle if I let it, but I don't. I can't laugh while I still hear Daddy's voice whispering that I'm his favorite. Sunlight creeps under my eyelids, climbs into my eyes. I curl over on my side and draw my knees up to my chest. Don't want to move, not ever. I hear Mama screaming at Lola to hurry up in the bathroom, and my heart catches in my throat. Benny is crying at the top of his lungs. I know I better get up unless I want Mama to know. I jump up and pull my nightgown over my head. At first I go to throw it in the dirty clothes hamper, then I stop and shove it under my mattress instead. My head feels dizzy, but when I hear Mama's voice in the hall, I know I gotta make everything look right. I stumble over to my dresser and pick out a clean nightgown. The new nightgown is soft on my skin. It smells like soap powder. I want to go lie down again and close my eyes. I want to sleep with the fresh smell, but I don't. I yank the edges of my sheets and tuck the corners under the mattress. I climb on top of the bed and throw the top sheet up high so it'll fall down flat. Before the sheet reaches the bed, I see them, two dark streaks, one short, one long. I go to pull them dirty sheets from the bed, but then I start thinking about how far away the clean sheets are. Be smarter to hide the stains from Mama, then try to get some fresh ones from the hall closet. I grip the edges of the top sheet and pull it smooth. If Mama comes to check on me now, she'd be real happy with how tight I made the bed. She'll be so proud, she'll never even see the stains. When I peek out into the hall, nobody's looking. I run straight to the bathroom and shut the door behind me. Before washing up, I wipe a warm washcloth between my legs. When I look at it, I see the same dark red streaks that were on the sheets. I rinse the washcloth and wipe till it shows no more red. Then I wash my face and brush my teeth. Mama is already at the stove when I sit at the table. No kiss for me this morning, she say. I don't move. I just sit at the table still as a stone. Rosa Mojo, you wake up on the wrong side of the bed, Mama laughs. Then she comes and kisses my cheeks. Daddy kisses me on top of my head like normal. I sit on my hands because if I didn't, I'd scratch his face and Mama would know something's wrong. Mama drops my plate down in front of me. The two huge yolks of my eggs are still jiggling from their journey from the stove. I don't say nothing, not even when Benny starts to tease me about how long it take me to get out of bed, not even when Lola steals two pieces of bacon from my plate while looking me dead in the face, not even when Mama says, Rosa Mojo's having a bad day and puts cheese on only my grits. Lola look at me and squint her eyes. When Mama go back to the stove and Daddy go to the coffee pot, she ball up her fist and say, you better not be doing no magic. I shake my head. I didn't do no magic, I swear. What you said, sweetheart? Daddy asked when he hear my flat voice. Nothing, Daddy, I say, and stir the cheese into my grits. Benny and Lola are loud in the backyard. Daddy and Mama been left, but I'm still sitting at the table, dirty dishes spread all over the tabletop. Lola runs into the kitchen with a knobby piece of branch. Benny comes in right behind her, carrying two sticks. Lola bangs the branch on the floor. Want to go scare some Nutri-Rats, she asks. I just shake my head no. We got you a stick, Benny say. I shrug my shoulders. We going then, she say, and I don't want to hear nothing about them dishes. I shrug my shoulders again. Lola looks close at me. What's wrong with you, she asks. I don't say nothing. Lola bang her stick on the floor, suck her teeth, and turn away. Come on, Benny, let's go to the canal. Rosa's acting all funny today. It feel like the air around me is thick, and I gotta move real slow. My favorite overalls be the only thing I can think of to make me feel better. I put them on before I eject the sheets from my bed. In the tub, I wash out the dark spots. I bring the sheets down the hall, down the stairs, through the living room, through the kitchen to the back door. Just when I'm about to step outside, I see nosy old Mrs. Roberts looking into our yard. I back up, arms still full of sheets. If Mrs. Roberts see me hanging up a sheet with a few wet spots, she gonna ask Mama if I got my cycle, and Mama gonna come asking me questions like she did Lola. So I go back upstairs to my room. I let the sheets fall out of my arms onto the bare mattress. Then I sit on my bed a while, thinking and staring out the window. Real quick like I get an idea. I jump up onto the mattress with my slippers on. I strain to lift the windows and struggle to get the screens out. I hang the flat sheet out one window and the fitted sheet out the other. Them wet spots should dry real quick. I just know I better get them screens back in before Mama gets home. In Mama and Daddy's room, everything is cool and quiet. It's like their room ain't part of the rest of the house. It's so dark in there, I can't see my reflection in neither of Mama and Daddy's two mirrors. I get real close on them, but I could barely make out my face. Then I start snooping around. I don't even know what I'm looking for until I see it. Daddy's favorite harmonica sitting on top of the dresser with Mama's combs and jewelry. I slip the harmonica into my side pocket. On the floor next to Daddy's side of the bed is the sports section. I crouch down and look at it. It's all marked up with inky black fingerprints. I roll it up and stick it in my back pocket. I go down the hall to the bathroom and stand on the step stool. In the medicine cabinet, I see lots of little bottles with words I can't read. Then I see Daddy's toothpicks. I put a handful in my front pocket and go to the kitchen with my loaded pockets. Beneath the sink is a burlap bag full of Daddy's favorite coffee. I grab the bag by the edges and drag it out the kitchen, through the living room to the front porch. Back in the kitchen, I find the metal bowl Mama uses to soak burnt pots and pans. I bring that to the porch, too. I stick the toothpicks in the harmonica holes and wrap the harmonica in the newspaper. My hand twitches. I look at it and suddenly remember Daddy's hair. I run upstairs and scoop up the hair from my dresser drawer. On the porch, I unwrap the newspaper and stick Daddy's hair into the harmonica holes, too. Then I wrap the whole thing up again. I put it in Mama's metal bowl and set the whole thing on fire. As I squat, watching it burn, my lips begin to move. Words come spilling out of my mouth, spelling out a protection prayer I never even knew I had in my head. When the fire burns out, the whole porch is cloudy with smoke. I use a dish rag to pick up Daddy's burnt things and shove them deep into the coffee beans. It seemed like it'd take forever for me to drag that bag of coffee upstairs, but I do it. By the time I stuff the bag under my bed, my arms are wet with sweat. When Lola and Benny come home, all the smoke from the fire is gone. I'm back sitting at the kitchen table, looking like I didn't move. My pockets are stuffed with cotton balls I took from under the bathroom sink. When Lola sees the dirty dishes still spread out over the table, she punches me hard. Why you didn't clean the dishes, stupid? I give her the same evil look she gave me this morning, and she backs off. She hates my magic. She liked it better when she could beat me up. Now she'd be a bit more careful. Come on, Benny, let's do the dishes, Lola says. Yeah, Benny says, like doing the dishes is a treat. After Mama tucks me in and turns out my light, I grab the cotton balls and put them under my pillow. Then I sit on top, and those prayers start coming out of me again. This time they come so fast, it's scary. I sit there for hours, mumbling to myself, waiting for Daddy to come home. When I hear Daddy's car creep into the driveway, I jump out of bed and drop down on my hands and knees. As the front door opens, I grab hold of the burlap bag and yank it hard. Daddy's footsteps are on the stairs. I'm tugging on the bag, but it don't come free. I got to get it unstuck somehow. I catch a tighter hold of the burlap, but it still won't come loose. I hear Daddy's footsteps at the top of the stairs, and I just panic. I run to my desk and snatch my scissors from the desk drawer. I stab the scissors into the bag. The bag splits, and coffee beans spill out. I jam my hand into the coffee and make wild grabs, feeling around for Daddy's stuff. He's so close now, I can almost feel him breathing down my neck. Instead of my door, I hear Mama and Daddy's door squeak open. I let out a little sigh, but I don't relax. I keep searching till my fingers touch something hard. Then I grab it, the burnt bundle of Daddy's stuff. Mama and Daddy's door squeaks again. I listen for a second, thinking maybe Daddy just got in bed, but no. I can hear the clunk, clunk of his footsteps. I stick my hand under my mattress and feel around for my magic pouch. Daddy's footsteps stop in front of my door, and it feels like my heart stops. I turn the pouch upside down and shake it wildly. Marbles, gum, and a picture of Ronald, the boy I have a crush on, spill to the floor. Daddy's turning the doorknob now. My fingers are shaking as I reach for the cotton. I stuff a little cotton into the bottom of the pouch and drop the bundle of Daddy's things on top. I turn to face Daddy as I fill the pouch up with cotton and a handful of coffee beans. Daddy's face is confused. He stands in the doorway as I tie the pouch closed and hang it around my neck. When I am finally still, he starts walking toward me. "Don't be scared, baby," Daddy says. I put my hand out in front of me, and Daddy stops short. I turn my palm up to the ceiling and imagine Daddy's heart rusting in my grasp. The second I feel the weight of his heart in my hand, I snap my fingers shut. Daddy gasps and bends over. I squeeze until the thing stops beating. Daddy stumbles away. The next morning, Mama's not in the kitchen. Me, Lola, and Benny go to Mama and Daddy's room. Lola pushes the door open, and me and Benny creep in behind her. Mama is sitting on the bed crying. She don't ask about the missing bag of coffee or her burnt metal bowl. She don't even notice how I bent the screens. The only thing she notices is Daddy. He's lying next to her, breathing heavy. His hands are shaking. His skin looks gray. "Lola, honey, go call an ambulance. Your daddy is sick. Benny, come with me downstairs. Help me make Daddy some tea. Rosa, stay here with your daddy. Call me if he starts to look worse." I nod my head, but I can't speak. When everyone leaves, I'm too frightened to move. I stay with my back against the wall, close to the door. "Rosa Mojo," I hear Daddy whisper. "Rosa Mojo." I don't say a word. "Rosa, make me well." Tears start to drip out my eyes, but I don't make a sound. "I won't do it again, Rosa. Give me my heart back." "I didn't mean to, Daddy," I whisper. "Can't you see how upset you're making your mama?" I put my hands over my ears. "Daddy, I didn't mean to," I say a little louder. "Take the hex off me, Rosa, please," Daddy says. But I can't. My mind is blank. Nothing comes. Not like the protection prayer that just spilled out of my lips. Not like I knew exactly what to do to grab hold of Daddy's heart. I can't think of anything at all. When Mama gets back, I'm crying hard. Mama kisses me. "Don't cry, sweet baby. Daddy will be fine." But I just cry harder because I know he won't. Mama hugs me. "Go downstairs with your sister and brother, sweetie. Let me talk to Daddy." But I don't move. I'm terrified Daddy will tell. Mama pushes me toward the door, but my body is stiff as an old oak. "Go ahead, honey," she says. "Go on downstairs." "Can I tell Daddy something first, Mama?" "Go ahead, Rosa." I force myself to walk close to the bed. "Don't tell, Daddy. Don't tell Mama, and I promise I'll fix it." Daddy grunts. He can't see my fingers crossed behind my back. It's not that I don't want to fix it. It's that I can't. If Daddy dies, things are going to get real bad. But I can't let Mama find out what I did. Not ever. I go downstairs and sit between Benny and Lola on the couch. Benny is crying. Lola is picking a scab on her knee. "You think Daddy's going to die?" Lola asks. When I don't answer, she shoves me. But I still don't say nothing. When the ambulance sirens get close, Benny stops crying. Before they even pull up in the yard, I feel a fire burn inside me. I don't say nothing to Lola, but that's how I know Daddy died. Mama screams loud and we all tense up. When Mama comes downstairs, she don't say nothing. She points the ambulance people to the stairs and sits on the couch with us. She spreads her arms wide and squeezes us tight. That night, I dream of Mama. Her face close to my face, we giggling and talking girl talk. But then I feel the string of my pouch pulling at my neck. My eyes fly open. Mama's face is close to my face, but ain't no giggle in her eyes. She's hanging over my bed and her hairline is all sweaty. She looking at me like she don't know me, like I'm not me, not a girl even, just some stubborn piece of meat she's tugging on. My hands fly up and I grab my pouch. Mama hiss out some air before she speak. Be sleep time, Rosa, she say. I know, Mama, but I can't sleep with you wrenching on my neck. Take it off then, Mama say, like she daring me or something. Mama, you know I always sleep with my pouch. Mama closes her eyes like she can't look at me while she's talking. Silence hang between us for so long I think I'm dreaming again. Then Mama open her eyes. She look at me like she's searching for the truth. You just a child, she say. Then she blink all the pity out her eyes and her voice get hard again. Empty out the pouch, Rosa. My heart starts beating double time. I start to cry. Why you want me to do that, Mama? I can't survive no more bad news, Rosa, she say with her teeth all clenched up. It's all got to come out tonight, so when the sun rise tomorrow, it's done. I start crying harder then. Mama stop talking and lick her lips. One second, she look like she want to love me. The next second, she look like she want to kill me. Her hands are shaking like she's been wrestling with the devil himself. Rosa, there's some things in life that's too trembling to understand and too wicked to look straight in the eye. You just a baby, and God knows I don't want to witness to this, but I can't lie to myself no more. Mama gives me a soft look, then evil steal back into her eyes. You should have stayed asleep, Rosa, and let me find out on my own. My legs start twitching because they want to run right out the room, but they're trapped in the twisted up sheets. Besides, there's no way I could get past Mama. Not tonight. I take a big old gulp of air, trying to slow down the hurt rushing out of my chest. I can't, I whisper, and I look at the wall instead of at Mama. I want to say, Mama, I can't, but I don't know if she still be my Mama after what I done to Daddy. Mama rise up to her feet then. I can feel the anger crackling off her like lightning. I never had no cause to hit you before, Rosa, and tonight is not the night to start. Now hush up and empty out that pouch. I don't want her to be mad at me, but it's like my whole body is yelling, no. I hunch my shoulders over and cover the pouch with my hands. Next thing I know, Mama is on me. She's scratching my face and neck, trying to rip off the pouch. When Mama finally get a good grip on the pouch, it don't make no noise. All the protest is coming from the draw of my breath and the thump of my heart. Soon as the pouch leave my body, I gets to shaking. I'm shaking so hard it feels like the whole house is trembling with me. I don't know who starts to wailing first, and I don't know who is the loudest. All I know is when Daddy burnt, harmonica hit the floor, me and Mama turned inside out. All our hurts like to drown us in that room. I go hot. I shiver with chills. I get ate up by fear, wild, hungry fear, worse than when Daddy was coming to my room that second time. When I can't take it no more, I just start to yelling. I yell so hard my throat starts to close up on me. Then Mama's voice break through all that noise. I can hear her screaming, why? Why? I'd do anything to make Mama understand, but my mouth is numb. I can't tell her the truth. If I tried to explain, the words would rip me right down the middle and break Mama into a million tiny pieces. Ask Daddy why, I whisper. And my whisper cut through all that screaming and wire up the air with electricity. Mama's chest is heaving like something evil is truly inside her. Sweat is pouring off her like the wet on a jelly jar fresh out the icebox. The rhythm of my breath scatter all over the place. My throat feel like roadkill and I can't gather enough air to keep my lungs going. The last thing I remember is Mama staring at me with a look I don't ever want to see again. Then my eyes roll back in my head and my body just give out. Next time I see Mama is at Daddy's funeral. First time I'm seeing Benny and Lola, too. Soon as Mama see me, she look at me real hard. Not mean or scared, but just studying, real serious. My ma's been fattening me up with pound cake and gumbo, but I don't think that's why Mama's staring. I think she's trying to peel me open with her eyes, trying to figure out if her little girl is still inside me. I want her to see I'm still me. I want her to love me like before. But if she don't, I won't fall to pieces like I thought I would before Mama got her hands on me. Mama give me peace and trust and plenty of hugs and kisses. She never look at me funny or make me feel like she suspect me of harboring the devil. She told me all God's children got their miracles and their struggles, and sometimes those two be the same thing. Then she brush my hair and tell me not to trouble myself with worry. After the funeral, Lola and Benny sit there gobbling up big plates of fried chicken with red beans and rice. They act like they don't miss me, but I catch them staring at me when they think I ain't looking. After the eating's done, Mama unwrapped 3 cakes. I snatch up a piece of one and sneak off. I can't take Mama's stares or Benny and Lola's looks no more. Don't know who else know I ain't been home, but I don't want to feel nobody's prying eyes picking me apart. I find a corner next to the china cabinet in Mama's sitting room. Ain't supposed to carry no food in here at all, but I mean to eat private, even if it gets me in trouble. Before I take my first bite, I feel somebody hit me on the shoulder. I look up, but I'm scared to look back. If I'm leaning on the wall, can't nobody hit me from behind, can they? I wait a while, but nothing happens. I break off a chunk of cake. That's when I feel that tap, tap on my shoulder again. This time I turn and look back. Ain't nobody there. I get up and move to the other side of the room. I settle down and bite into Mama's cake real quick before that old tapping can stop me. While I'm chewing, I hear Daddy's voice inside my head. "It good, Rosa?" he say. I jump and look around. Daddy laugh. "You can't see the dead, Rosa." "Daddy, that you?" I whisper. Daddy don't say nothing. I take a sad look at my cake. Look like don't nobody want to let me eat in peace. I get up and take my cake to the backyard. Soon as I get outside, Daddy start talking again. "Rosa, you have to forgive me." I slam my plate down on the picnic table. "Me? Forgive you?" "Yeah, I want to go where my soul's supposed to go, but..." Daddy felt fall silent. My lip starts to poke out like it does when I'm feeling prickly. "Rosa, you holding me back. That's why you sneaking around here, tapping on my shoulder at your own funeral? Rosa, I need you to forgive me so I can go where I need to go." I go quiet on that one. Me forgiving him make it seem like he didn't do nothing wrong. "You gotta tell Mama what happened," I say and cross my arms. "How'ma do that, Rosa? You the only one that could hear me." A big knot of sobs is welling up in my throat, but I choke it down. "You ain't the only one who can't go where you're supposed to. I ain't been home since you left. Mama don't even want me no more." "But Mama taking good care of you, Rosa. I'm nowhere." I turn my back to Daddy, which I realize is stupid real quick because Daddy is everywhere and nowhere at once. "I can't help you till you make Mama know I am not the devil's child. Once I make your Mama know the truth, then you'll forgive me?" I sit down on the picnic bench in a heap. I feel like all the air done left my body. Finally, I say, "Daddy, can I forgive you even if I'm glad you dead?" Daddy go real quiet. After a while, I figure he's gone. "Daddy?" Daddy clears his throat. "Did Daddy hurt you that bad, Rosa?" I nod my head, "and you was gonna keep doing it." Then Daddy quiet again. Finally, he say, "Sometimes right and wrong not so easy to sort out, Rosa." "I'm a child, Daddy," I wail. "I'm not ready for grown-up things." My voice starts shaking. Before I know it, I'm bawling. "It's all right, Rosa," Daddy say. "I can see you not ready to forgive me. I'm terrible sorry you hurtin' so bad. I never meant to do you wrong. I'm a go now, but I'll be back. I'm not gonna push you, but you can't make me stay here forever. You're gonna have to forgive me and let me go where I need to go." I don't answer. I just sniff real hard. It take me a while to pull myself together. I look at the tops of trees. I stare up under some birds as they fly by. I watch a stretch of raggedy-looking clouds float on in the sky. When my tears finally dry up, I wipe off my face and head back to the house. When I grab hold of the door, I hear Daddy again. "Rosa, honey, please promise me you'll at least think about forgiving me." "I will," I say tiredly. "I ain't got no more fight left in me." "You promise?" "I promise." And I'm still keeping that promise to this very day.
Wow. Yes.
Rosa Mojo.
Rosa Mojo from the collection of stories, Ancient, Ancient, published by Aqueduct Press, proudly published. They do a great job over there. They really do. Written and read for you by Ki'ini Ibura Salam. And we are going to spell that now because I know that you're not looking at your radio to see how that's spelled, but it's K-I-I-N-I, new word, I-B-U-R-A, new word, S-A-L-A-A-M. And the website is it Ki'ini Ibura Salam?
Yeah. No,
just Ki'ini Salam.
Ki'ini Ibura.
Ki'ini Ibura. Okay, yeah. You see, and I get confused because I know in some places you're Kini Salam.
In my personal life.
Ah, that's what it is. Okay.
And in my writing life, and I'm the whole...
You're the whole three
the whole
words.
Shebang.
Yeah, the whole shebang.
Yeah.
And wow. I mean, we're out of time, but I'm sorry, Lister. I am going to take 2 minutes more of your airtime. Where did that story come from?
Where did the story come from?
Yeah.
I have to say...
I mean, first of all, by the way, I don't consider that science fiction or speculative fiction in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. It's the least speculative. I always have a problem picking a story to read because the stories in this book run the gamut from what I call everyday magic, which is what I just read,
mm-hmm.
to actual sci-fi with some modulated spaceship type thing,
mm-hmm.
to speculative fiction with aliens on Earth who have a mission, to, you know, a grandfather who's punishing his grandson by sending him time traveling,
mm-hmm.
you know, to the past and to this future that's horrible, almost kills his grandson trying to give him a lesson, you know, to a dystopic near future. So the stories really run the gamut. And I'm always like, when I have to pick a story, I feel like I'm going to stereotype the book in one way or another. You know?
And you can't. You are a moving target as a writer. You really are. And it makes you amazing. And if people want to see this target move, KGB Fantastic Fiction, third Wednesday in January.
That's right.
At 85 East 4th Street, free admission. And who are you reading with?
I don't know yet. We set the date, and I don't know.
Yeah,
who
I'll
I'm
be recording.
With.
I got a big
okay,
problem.
Great.
I have a big problem going to those because they're Wednesday nights.
Okay.
And it's sort of difficult for me to go there Wednesday nights, record, and all that. So Gordon Linsner has been recording a lot of them for me, but I want to be there when you're there reading because.
And then the next night at the Brooklyn Museum, February 20th, I'm organizing a celebration of Octavia Butler.
Oh, God.
With N.K. Jemisin. Myself, E.B. Zaboy, and actually a poet performance artist, Mendy Lewis, celebrating Octavia Butler.
Okay, now you see that. Okay, I need copy for that so
yes.
we can promote it on the radio.
Yeah, and I will give it to you once it's set.
Yeah.
And it's set. It's
can I have permission to record that?
Yes, of course. That would be wonderful. We actually want to do a whole conversation with Madame Butler.
Junie.
So I'm working on it.
Yeah.
Right now, as we speak.
Yeah. Okay. So, wow, that's going to be one heck of an event.
Yes.
Another great event is Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister, whose airtime we are transcending upon. But you are so wonderful, Lister. Thank you so much for being the person that you are. Thank you. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, Ki'ini Obura Salam.
Yes.
We had to take out some time for pitching. And God knows.
And then we were just going on.
That was such a pleasure. It was such a pleasure. But we have so many agendas to talk. We had so much to talk about. And we're going to have to do this again.
Oh, definitely.
Soon.
Yeah.
Not this, like, 13 years since you've been on
the
show.
I know, it's crazy, right?
And it's just wrong.
Well, when I win the Knicks Award, I'll come back.
Well, no. I mean, that'll be soon enough. But when WBAI moves to your nabe.
That sounds great.
I'll
walk on over.
Yeah, if that happens, it's not that far a walk.
Yeah.
And we don't want to give more information than that. But,
no.
Okay, but thank you, Ki'ini, for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lister, for use of your airtime. Thank you. Yeah, and thank you, everybody, for listening, for tuning in.
Yes.
And now we're in the future because it is available, of course, at ourwolf.com or archive.wbai.org. So for 2 weeks,
great.
It's available there, but I'll let you know.
Okay, awesome.
How to get more out of it. So, again, thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Next week, I have no idea what I'm doing on the show next week. None whatsoever. And that's a good thing. The week after that... Christmas morning. The Council of Elrond by J.R.R. Tolkien, our annual broadcast produced by myself, Dave Marks, and Margot Adler, read by Baird Searles. And the week after that, it's New Year's morning. So music. It's going to be a fun show. Stay tuned for Lister and enjoy yourselves. Good morning. Mm-hmm.
And you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. 7 minutes after 3 o'clock, this is Burn, Baby Burn, yeah? Great show, Jim Farn. 516-620-3602. This is the Begathon, y'all.
Like many others take the same turn like me, they yearn for the flag too.